reason is limited in that it does not afford the capacity for the discernment of essence or the critical point of a complex issue, and generally disregards context. A quote by David Hawkins. The real I is context, not content. A quote by David Hawkins. When I was in elementary school in fourth grade, we had a tradition. Now, I don't know how it was at your school, but at our school, the way it worked is the kid whose birthday it was responsible for getting his parents to bring in the cake, or the cupcakes in this case, to throw the celebration party. And so at the end of the day, we would have this celebration party for that kid. So on my birthday in fourth grade, I got my mom to bring in a couple of batches of cupcakes that she got from the store. It was like two large tins for the whole class. It was about 30 or so cupcakes for 30 kids. And my mom brought these in the morning when she dropped me off at school. And then I gave these tins of cupcakes to my teacher for safekeeping for the end of the day when we would have the celebration. And so I gave them to her, and I went off and just kind of played around and did my own stuff. Now, it was still relatively early in the morning, maybe close to the afternoon, that I noticed one of the kids in the class running by me with one of the cupcakes, eating it in a very sort of taunting manner, very seductively eating it and kind of like rubbing it in on my face, like, oh, Leo, such a good cupcake, and just devouring this whole thing and then running off. And this happened, and I was just kind of like dumbstruck, like, how could this happen? This son of a bitch stole one of my cupcakes. How could the teacher let him steal one of these cupcakes? But I tend to not be too confrontational, so I held this in. But I stewed and I stewed for the rest of the day, all the way till the end of the school day. I stewed about how this guy got away with stealing one of my cupcakes, and I was angry at him, and I was angry at the teacher, but I kept it inside. And then we had the party at the end of the day, and it went fine. Everyone was happy. And then finally, when I was getting ready to go home, the whole class had left, and it was just me and the teacher. And I just couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't hold it back. And so finally, I burst out to the teacher and I say, how could you? How could you have let this guy get away with stealing one of my cupcakes? And she says, oh, you mean Brendan? Oh, yeah. As I was putting your cupcakes away into the cupboard for safekeeping, one of them fell out of the tin onto the floor. And so I was going to throw it into the trash can. And just as I was about to throw it in the trash can, Brendan ran by and he begged me for the cupcake. So I let him have it. And that completely changed my entire feelings about that whole situation. I couldn't be angry at Brendan anymore. I couldn't be angry at the teacher anymore. And the whole thing just melted away. That is what I mean by recontextualization. And that's what we're going to be talking about a lot today. There's a lot of deep stuff to say about this. I'm really excited about this topic of recontextualization. In fact, this is a word, a new vocabulary word that I want you to add to your self-actualization vocabulary. Write it down and remember it, because I'll be referencing this word a lot in the future, because it has a lot of profound ramifications, which we're going to help to flesh out today. This is actually a topic from the book that I want to write about, Epistemology, where I'm going to talk about a lot of these sorts of interesting topics of the mind. What I'm really fascinated by is the deceptive nature of the mind and how the mind can shift perspectives, how the mind can lose track of itself, get lost in its own, in itself, really. And there's many topics that are necessary to discuss to explain all of that, and that's what the book is about. But I'm kind of giving you a teaser about it here. One of the topics is recontextualization. So, what is context? Context is the backdrop which frames a set of facts. And there can be different kinds of context. You can have historical context, which gives you a frame or a backdrop for some historical event, or a literary context, which gives you the backdrop for a particular sentence or passage or chapter in a novel, for example, right? To really understand a sentence or a chapter in a long novel, you need to read the entire novel because that frames what that chapter means. There can be social contexts. So something that you do out in public or in a social setting, like you go to a party or whatever, whether it's appropriate or not, how people react to it is going to very much depend on the context. So whatever you're doing has to match the context, the social context that you're doing it in. For example, if you're at a fancy dinner party that's serving champagne and caviar and everyone's dressed in tuxedos and ties and ballroom gowns, then you go farting in that environment, that's out of context. That's going to create problems for you. On the other hand, if you're on a Saturday night at home on the couch with a bunch of your friends drinking beer and smoking pot and having a farting contest, then farting in that context is completely socially acceptable. And in fact, it would be weird for you not to participate. They would look at you cross-eyed. Well, they would look at you cross if you didn't participate. There's also metaphysical context, which is, well, that's the really juicy topic, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Now, the word recontextualization, what does that mean? That means a change in context, a change in framing, or a change in the backdrop, which informs a certain set of facts or how you see a certain situation. Now, this might sound like kind of an arcane, esoteric, kind of a nerdy topic, like, Leo, why would this be important? This mechanism of recontextualization is very important because it opens up an interesting possibility. It opens up the possibility of radically changing your understanding of a situation or of some brute facts without changing the facts themselves. And that's critical. That's so important. And you'll understand why it's so important by the time we get to the end of this episode, because it's probably still not clear. But what I'm really driving at is this problem that we see with science, with materialism, and with rationalism. People who subscribe to this paradigm, generally they commit the mistake of believing that, Leo, just give me the facts. You know, don't worry about the interpretations and opinions. You've got your perceptions and interpretations and opinions, but then there are like the brute scientific facts, and you can't argue with those, man. And so sometimes they'll criticize maybe some certain topics that I talk about as being pseudoscientific or as being mystical or as being fantastical or as being kind of woo-woo and sloppy, not hard science, because hard science deals with the brute facts, and spirituality and mysticism and personal development and psychology, this is sort of a higher order, kind of fluffy, we might call it the social sciences sort of thing. It's like the division between physics and some kind of social studies science, like maybe anthropology or feminism or women's studies or something like that, right? You make this kind of distinction. The rationalists love to make this distinction. And then what they carry on with that distinction is there's a sort of like implication from that if you have the brute facts as physics reports them to you, those cannot be argued with and those cannot change. And therefore, the fundamental building blocks of reality can never be really challenged because those are just the physical brute facts. And what I'm saying here with this concept of recontextualization is that now we have a mechanism for how we can radically change your understanding of the world without affecting the brute facts, which is a very important mechanism because a lot of people who are stuck within materialism and rationalism just cannot comprehend how something like enlightenment or some of the other mystical stuff that I talk about, how it can possibly be true because it doesn't reconcile with the hard physical facts of physics and of science. Now, in fact, there is no contradiction, but there can be an apparent contradiction when you don't understand and take into account this mechanism, recontextualization. what recontextualization offers us is a mechanism for how reality can hide very significant truths from you in plain sight. And the way it does that is because the really deep truths in life, they are not in the brute facts. They are in the context, which gives meaning and significance to those facts. As it turns out, context is way more important than content. So context is the background, content is the foreground. And most people get so preoccupied with the foreground or the brute facts that they forget about the radical importance of context. And that's what I want to show to you in this episode today. I want to show you how a change in context can flip facts around 180 degrees, such that when you think something is true just by looking at the content, then by taking into account the context, you realize that actually what you thought was true is false, and vice versa, what you thought was false now becomes true. And this allows us to turn science completely inside out, upside down, without actually challenging the physical facts and discoveries of materialist science, because many of their discoveries we don't want to challenge. And sometimes people will mistake me as being anti-science when really I'm not about anti-science at all. What we need to do is we need to take the discoveries of science but put them into the proper context. So whenever I'm ranting against science, which I will be a little bit in this episode, I'm not ranting about the content of science so much as I am about science's lack of understanding about this problem of context. So it turns out that facts are actually not as important as people think. Because what you really care about in life is not the facts, if you're honest. What you care about is you care about making sense of things. You care about understanding. And when it comes to making sense or understanding something, that very much hinges upon getting the right context, such that even if you get the right content but the wrong context, you will still be wrong. And vice versa, if you get the right context but you screw up the content a little bit, you get your facts wrong a little bit, you're still going to be right in the big picture. So recontextualization is such an important concept because it explains why mindfucks happen. And so really this episode here will dovetail nicely with a prior episode that I did called The Topic of Mindfuckery, where I talk about mindfucks and what they are, and I give you many examples. So this is kind of like a part two to that, which is going to explain why these mindfucks happen and how you can anticipate them. And this will help you to explain a lot of the weird stuff that you will discover at the highest levels of personal development and mysticism and non-duality. This is a way that we can turn the most certain convictions that we have about reality upside down. And I hope you can see how significant that can be. But let me give you some examples just to drive this point home. So let's start with a linguistic example. Let's start with a phrase like, a man is jumping. Simple sentence, right? And if I just told you, let's just treat this like a physical fact, as though science was studying this, and science discovered that, hey, a man is jumping. But what does a man is jumping really mean without context? Let me show you what happens when you change the context of a man is jumping. So listen to the following recontextualizations. I'm going to say a man is jumping, then I'm going to pause, and then I'm going to give you the recontextualization. Rather, what I'm going to do is I'm going to expand the context such that the meaning of the phrase completely changes. So here we go. A man is jumping on a trampoline. Now, that's a very simple example. And maybe in that one, you didn't quite notice the change. But even there, I still want you to notice the change. It might have been a subtle change. So what I want you to do is go inside and actually notice that when I first told you a man is jumping, in your mind you had some kind of image, and probably it was a very average, stereotypical image of what a man is jumping is like. And usually when you think of a man is jumping, you probably have an image of a man jumping like on the ground. Maybe you imagine him jumping for joy or jumping for some other reason, but that's probably your image. But notice that there's a lot of other ways that a man could be jumping than just jumping on the ground or maybe jumping to throw a basketball or something like that. There's many different ways. And so the additional details that I give you change the context of what a man is jumping really means. So when I add the additional context of a man is jumping on a trampoline, then now your picture changes. It's like, oh, that significantly changes my original picture. Now, maybe you imagine a man jumping on a trampoline to be your prototypical image. Okay, well, if that's the case, we got more examples which will, again, shift your image significantly. So here we go. A man is jumping to take a bullet for the president. That's a pretty different image than the one you originally had. A man is jumping on thin ice. A man is jumping on the corpse of his mother. Now, notice that's a significantly different scene than what you probably imagined when I originally said a man is jumping. You probably didn't imagine a man jumping on the corpse of his mother. And in fact, in real life, if you discovered that your best friend was jumping on the corpse of his mother, that would probably shock you and would probably elicit some sort of emotional or moral outrage within you, some kind of emotional reaction. That might affect how you feel. It might even make you violent towards this person, depending on how radical of a recontextualization this is, right? Like, you might find out that your best friend was sleeping with your girlfriend. And when you find that out, that's going to affect you in a very significant way. You see? So the context matters very much. Now, if I told you that your best friend slept with your girlfriend, but really, he did it because he was forced to, because they were both kidnapped by a crazy serial killer who was into some kinky sex type stuff. And what he really wanted to do is he wanted to watch and kind of like force these two people into an awkward situation. So he forced them to have sex at gunpoint while he sat there watching and jerking off to it and videotaping it for his own amusement. See, again, I changed the context of that situation another time such that now, again, it's been recontextualized in your mind such that now you have a little bit more understanding about the situation. Before, maybe you were really angry that your best friend slept with your girlfriend. But now you realize, oh, it was actually under the circumstances of being under the point of a gun. It's like, oh, yeah, I can understand that. And so now, again, your situation or your understanding of the situation changes significantly. So it's not just about the facts. It's about the context. Some more examples. A man is jumping on the head of a turtle, as in Super Mario Brothers. A man is jumping in his dream. A man is jumping on TV. A man is jumping in a comic book. A man is jumping into a pool with no water. So that's a double recontextualization right there. So first I told you he's jumping into a pool, and so you have an image of a man jumping into a pool. But your prototypical image of a man jumping into a pool is probably one where the pool is filled with water, isn't it? That's what you assume. You don't bother to go and really question your assumptions and consider the possibility, what if the pool is empty? So when I tell you that additional fact, that turns out to be a very significant fact and really changes the picture. That could mean the difference between life and death, whether a man is jumping into a pool with water or no water. Very significant. It would be extremely significant to you if it was happening to you. It would be extremely significant to you if I was telling you this story about your child. Like I said, hey, me and your kid, we went to the pool and he jumped into the pool, but there was no water in the pool. Like that would shock you when you heard that, because you can connect the dots, you see. How about a man is jumping ahead of the gun? Now that one's interesting, because now we've even taken it out of the realm of sort of literal meanings, because now we're sort of using it figuratively. He didn't actually jump in this case. In this case, we're saying that he cheated in the race. He jumped ahead of the gun, but he didn't actually jump. He just started early. He started ahead of the clock. So notice that now I've completely changed what a man is jumping really is. It has nothing even to do with a man physically jumping up and down. A man is jumping ahead in the novel. Again, has nothing to do with physical jumping. He maybe is bored with some chapter in the novel, so he's jumping ahead to the next chapter for something more exciting. That's not actually a jump, not a physical jump. How about a man is jumping down his wife's throat? Now, he's not physically jumping down her throat. He's having an argument, he's scolding her, something like that. That's what we mean. When I originally said a man is jumping, did you imagine that I could have meant that he's actually jumping down his wife's throat? Probably not. That's probably very far from what you thought I meant. Notice that there's this entire ever-expanding, almost infinite field of possibilities for what a man is jumping really means. And you basically didn't consider almost any of them when I first started talking about this. Now, as I'm talking more, you're starting to expand your domain of possibilities. Now you're starting to think a little bit outside the box. How about a man is jumping out of his skin? Or a man is jumping to conclusions? Or a man is jumping through hoops? Now, he's not literally jumping through hoops. We usually say this figuratively. He's jumping through hoops to please somebody or to do something for his company, to get through some red tape, that sort of thing. A man is jumping at the opportunity. How about this? A man is jumping into bed with his mother. Certainly changes the meaning of things, doesn't it? How about this one? A man is jumping out of an airplane with a defective parachute in his dream in a movie. That was 1, 2, 3, 4. That was 4 recontextualizations in one scene. And notice how significantly different that is. Imagine if you were in that situation. Imagine if you were jumping out of an airplane with a defective parachute. But then you realized, this is just a dream. But then actually this wasn't even a dream. It was being depicted on a movie screen that this was happening. You see how we're fucking with the reality of the situation. So the question is, what's actually real here? Is this a movie? Is this a dream? Is this real life? What really is it? And how do we know when we finally gotten to the truth of things, to the ultimate context? You see the problem with context? Is that if we can keep expanding the context forever, how will you ever know when you've gotten to the bottom line? And if you haven't gotten to the bottom line, then how can you actually be certain that anything you know is actually true? And this is a really deep problem of epistemology. This is the problem of knowing. How do you know anything for sure? How do you know that the thing you know won't be radically recontextualized by some future discovery? That's why this concept is so important. Put another way, recontextualization is, imagine a picture such that when you zoom out, the entire meaning of the picture gets reversed. imagine a portrait photograph of a woman who's smiling and she's just happy like this. But then you zoom out a little bit and you see there's a gun pointed to her head. And the man is threatening to pull the trigger unless she smiles. Certainly changes the entire context of that photograph, doesn't it? Just by zooming out a couple of feet, you get to see that gun that wasn't visible there before. So before, you might have said, oh yeah, the woman is happy. Like this, she's just happy. But when you see the gun, the smile, even though she's smiling, that no longer says she's happy. The situation has changed entirely. So my question to you is, how do you know that everything that you understand as rock solid physical reality won't be recontextualized in the future to be something that right now it isn't, just by a little bit of zooming out? Think about that. We'll get back to that. Here's another example. Here's an image. Imagine a man who's resting comfortably on a soft, silky cushion in a coffin 6 feet underground while he's still alive. So it's a double recontextualization. Imagine this one. Picture a hot girl at a nightclub, if you're a guy, who's really into you, or maybe if you're a girl, imagine a hot guy is really into you. He's handsome, he's attractive, he's 6 foot tall, muscular, really into you. But then this guy turns out to be a prostitute. Wow, that certainly changes the situation, doesn't it? When you learn that. Has that ever happened to you? It's happened to me once or twice, especially here in Las Vegas. Happens pretty often, actually. Happens so often you get good at seeing it before it even comes. But still, sometimes it catches you off guard and it's like, damn, that was quite a mindfuck. But let's go further. Imagine further that this hot girl is a vampire. She's a prostitute and she's a vampire. Now, that really changes the situation, doesn't it? You would think twice about sleeping with her then. Imagine a man is covered in blood who's riding into battle on a horse in a Civil War reenactment in front of a blue screen on a Hollywood film set as seen by an editor on his computer as he's editing the final movie. That was a triple recontextualization. So originally you just had the man riding into battle and you assumed that it was just a real battle. That's what you just assumed. That's your implicit assumption. But then, no, it's a reenactment. So they're just pretending. They're not really going to kill people. Okay, but then, oh no, it's not even a reenactment. It's a Hollywood set. And it's not even a Hollywood set. This is something now an editor is watching on his computer screen after it's long been filmed. Years later, perhaps. You see how we're fucking with the reality of the situation and how easily you can get confused if you just focus on the content and ignore the context. It's really important to know that this whole thing is happening inside of a computer and not real life. And if you confuse those things, you can see how that can lead to great delusion. So now you're starting to see why the big picture is so important and why I emphasize big picture thinking in pretty much all of my content so much. Because the big picture can completely recontextualize the little picture. And so if you get overly preoccupied with the little picture, you can get the little picture totally right, but you can screw up the big picture, which will render your little picture completely useless. In the same way that you can win a battle in a war, but lose the whole war. So what I'm really concerned about in life, because I'm a human being first and foremost, before I'm a scientist, before I'm a philosopher, before I'm a speaker, before I'm a business person, I am a human being. And as a human being, as a living thing, which is a part of reality, I am therefore reality, because anything that is living is by definition a part of reality. Therefore, as reality, the highest level issue that I'm concerned about is what is reality and getting that picture right. Because if I get that picture wrong, everything else is content within reality. And so my number one priority then becomes in life to find out, am I getting the right context for what reality is? Unfortunately, most people don't approach life that way. And that leads them to great delusion and much problems. Emotional problems, relationship problems, problems within science, problems within philosophy, problems within psychology, and everywhere else. Political problems, social problems, sexual problems, all the problems stem from this ultimate problem, which is why I stress the big picture, and which is why what I encourage you to do is to make a commitment right now and for the rest of your life to be really focused on the big picture and to not get lost in the details, in the minutiae. This is a very sneaky and subtle trap that a lot of very intelligent people fall into. There are many people in the world who are top-notch academics and have PhDs and even Nobel Prizes, but they get those Nobel Prizes and PhDs for little picture thinking, not for big picture thinking. And even though their little picture can be good, their big picture can be terrible. And then from that, everything else goes wrong. What's more important than the facts is how the facts get selected and framed. And this is the biggest thing that science, modern science, struggles with. They're really, really good at finding the facts, but they're terrible at properly selecting the facts and properly framing and interpreting the facts. In fact, there is an entire denial. There's a philosophical denial that what I'm talking about here is even significant to the enterprise of science. Scientists act as though the facts are just the facts, man, and we'll just discover them, and whatever they are, they just are. And the facts, they're not biased. My ego's not going to abuse the facts, and it doesn't matter which facts I select and how the facts are framed. None of that stuff is significant. And maybe they'll concede that, Leo, yeah, maybe what you're talking about is true in the social sciences. Maybe in the social sciences, it is important how the facts are selected and how they're framed, but not in the physical sciences, not in chemistry, not in biology, not in physics, not in mathematics. This is the problem. That in and of itself is little picture thinking, which ignores the significance of context. The most important context is metaphysical context. What do I mean by this? I mean that you have a backdrop, an entire web of concepts, which is used for interpreting your very present experience that you are having right now and your entire experience of life, including science, mathematics, and relationships and business and politics and anything else that you will ever do in life. And the problem is that this context is never made explicit. Nobody ever tells you what this context is. Context is when you're going to school, when you're in college, when you're learning at work and other places. Nobody really explicates it for you. And so you're walking around with this metaphysical web of beliefs, which constitute the context, the metaphysical context that you are interpreting all of reality from. It's the backdrop against which you see the foreground. And you're unaware of this backdrop. And you're not even aware that you are interpreting reality. You just take your interpretations as reality. And that's the whole problem. So what are some examples of this metaphysical context that I'm talking about? Well, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot. There's so much of it that it would take you years to fully explicate it. That's why it's so challenging. And it's really buried deep in your mind. But generally, here's the metaphysical context that most human beings have. It's the dualistic, materialistic context. So you actually believe, and you right now are interpreting your present experience from the following context. You believe that you were born, that you are a human being, that you are alive in the 21st century, that you are inside of a universe, This is a physical universe. It has a lot of depth to it, and basically the deeper you go, the more you zoom in, ultimately you discover that it's physicalistic and that it's made out of molecules and particles, and that particles are bouncing around and this stuff is happening, and that this can be tracked with the laws of physics and mathematics. You believe that you will die. And you have this sort of even further, even a deeper context, sort of a meta context, which tells you that none of this stuff that I just said is context. You believe that it's fact. Of course, there's a lot more that we could add to it, but this is just sort of the beginning, just to start to reveal a little bit of this context to you. Here's some examples that will further illustrate what I'm talking about here with metaphysical context. So when you are outside, have you noticed this? When you look at the sun setting or rising, you can look at it in two ways. One way you can look at it is you can actually look at it as though the sun is setting, let's say. And so you're seeing the sun set. Now, visually, the sun is setting. But of course, you know just from basic elementary school science classes that the sun is actually not moving. It's the Earth which is rotating. And the Earth is kind of rotating backwards, and it's because the Earth is rotating backwards that it appears the sun is sort of rotating forwards over the horizon. Now, be honest, when you actually look at the sun setting, do you think of the sun as moving, or are you conscious that it's actually the Earth that's moving? That's a tricky one, because you might actually be very scientific. You might be a physicist. You know, I took 2 years of advanced physics in university because I was studying to be an aerospace engineer, and I was good at physics. I enjoyed physics. But when I still go outside today and I look at the sun, if I'm honest, to me, the sun looks like it's setting. And I don't usually think of the Earth as spinning. I think of the sun as actually moving. Now, of course, I know better. Logically, I know better. If I go inside my mind, I think about it. Yeah, of course, I know what's actually happening. I know the theory. But here's the point. The point is that all of that theory is context. What you're literally seeing in both cases, whether you think the sun moves or it doesn't, whether you are a modern human being today who knows that the Earth orbits the sun, or maybe you're somebody from 1,000 years ago, back before Copernicus, who believed that the Earth was the center of the universe. In both cases, the empirical evidence is identical. When you look at the sun, it always appears that the sun is sort of moving. That's what it appears like. You never actually experience the Earth moving. So whether you believe the Earth, if you believe that the Earth is actually moving, what that is that's a context. You see, it was actually a breakthrough in genius. Some genius person like Copernicus had to come along and had to recontextualize the situation, come up with a conceptual framework which actually says, no, it's not how it appears. It's actually backwards from what it appears. It appears, we humans have been alive for thousands of years, and it's always appeared that the sun was moving around the Earth. But no, that appearance is wrong. He had to create that conceptual context for himself to recontextualize the situation. And then when he looked at the sun, it looked very different to him in that context, even though the facts of the situation didn't actually change. That's why science is so tricky. It's never about looking at something and just saying, oh, that's what it is. It's never that simple, because to say that something is this way or that way is to have a conceptual web of background beliefs, which is informing what you're saying. Which is why science gets itself into a lot of trouble and can easily misinterpret and misunderstand reality, even though it gets the facts right. Technically, the facts are right. Like if a scientist 2,000 years ago measured the motion of the sun, he could measure the actual motion of the sun. Like it moves a couple of inches per hour, or per 5 minutes, or per whatever span of time you want to calculate it at. So he could actually measure the rate of the sun's motion. And that would be true. Technically, the measurement is correct. The question is, what is he actually measuring? That's what really matters. A similar thing we could say as an example is how you view the stars today. Today, when you go out and you look at the stars, because you have a background context that you got from elementary school, which informs you of what stars really are, stars are just suns, just very far away. So you look at them and it takes your breath away. Maybe if you're out in the desert and you're looking at the Milky Way and it's just like hundreds, thousands, you see all these thousands of stars and it's just amazing. And you realize like, oh my God, those are all solar systems, an entire galaxy so far away, just like our sun. They probably have planets like ours rotating around them. But what is that? You're not seeing any of that in that picture. That's not evident in your perceptions. That's all conceptual context. Now you might say, Leo, but it's true. But the question is, how do you know it's true? Because someone told you in school? Have you ever actually taken a telescope and looked through the telescope to confirm that stars are actually suns? Is that even possible with a kind of an amateur telescope? Or would you need some sort of like massive laboratory telescope to be able to confirm that? If even you could with one of those, maybe you need the Hubble telescope to confirm that. See, have you actually looked with your own eyes? No, probably not. And yet you believe it. And see, this is the blind spot of science, is that although science believes and likes to tell itself that it doesn't operate on beliefs because it's fact-based and it's empirical, that's only a half-truth. The reality is that 99% of what you call science is purely conceptual. And within those 99% is where all the epistemic errors happen, where you make gross errors about the nature of reality within those 99%. Now you could say, Leo, but some of those conceptual, contextual things that I have in the back of my mind, for example, that stars are actually suns, it's true. Ultimately, if we took the Hubble telescope and we photographed it, we would find out that it's true. Maybe. You're assuming that, though. You see, that's also part of your context, is you're assuming that's true without actually having ever verified it. Therefore, technically, if we want to be epistemically technically accurate here, your belief that stars are suns is technically no different than a fundamentalist Islamic terrorist's belief that killing civilians will get him into heaven. There is absolutely no difference epistemologically there, if we want to be technical. There will be a difference if you actually pull out a telescope and look through that telescope and you can actually verify for yourself. But until then, it's just a belief. And that's how it is for most of science. So while it's true that there is a difference between science and religion in the sense that science has that 1% of empirical validation, it still has 99% of concepts and webs of belief and lots of stuff taken on blind faith. And what's even more similar between science and religion is that you will adamantly deny that what I'm saying here is actually true. You will want to draw a sharp boundary. If you're a materialist or a scientist or an atheist or a rationalist, you will want to draw a very sharp demarcation between science and religion. And you will want to say that there is a big difference. Leo, there's a big difference because science is empirical. And we can validate it with formulas. And the difference is, Leo, that in the past, human beings have actually looked at this stuff. Galileo, he looked at it and he verified it for us. Or somebody else verified it for me. Right? But fundamentalist Islamist will say the same thing. That in the past, Muhammad has verified all these truths for him. And so today, he's just standing on the shoulders of giants, the way that you are standing on the shoulders of giants. So who's right? Who are you going to believe? You see the problems here? Very tricky stuff. How about atomic theory as an example? You probably, if you're scientifically minded, you think about what is reality? And you look at objects, and maybe sometimes you even look at an object and you start to wonder like, oh, look at that... look at that coffee mug that's sitting on the table. Oh, it's made out of atoms. And those atoms are made out of further subdivision of subatomic particles and quarks and strings or whatever nonsense you believe in. But notice that that's all conceptual, contextual stuff that you bring to the situation. In fact, you've never actually seen an atom in your entire life. See? So it's very significant for you to start to understand and to start to distinguish between what is actually empirical fact in your direct experience versus conceptual metaphysical background stuff. Because where all your mistakes lie is in your conceptual metaphysical background stuff. So the mistake that people make when they hear me criticizing science is they think that what I'm criticizing science on is the empirical data. No, I don't criticize the empirical data. The empirical data is what it is. Like, if you take that coffee cup and you measure it with a ruler and you find out that it's 2 inches wide, that's what it is. I don't dispute that part. What I dispute is all the conceptual baggage that you bring into the situation and how you think of that cup and all the theories you have about it and what you think it means and where you think it came from and all of that. Because none of that is actually found in direct experience. All of that stuff is a vastly complicated web of metaphysical concepts that are interlinked to each other in a very complicated and messy manner, and that can lead to all sorts of problems. And it's there that the problems lurk, not in the actual coffee cup and the measuring of the 2-inch diameter and all that sort of stuff. And of course, if you're a student of history, especially epistemic history and scientific history, then you know that what I'm describing here perfectly explains all the scientific epiphanies and discoveries and recontextualizations that have happened throughout scientific history. So for example, we had Isaac Newton, who basically thought that there was absolute time and space and objects moved around in it, there was gravity, blah, blah, blah. And then Einstein came along and shattered that entire paradigm, radically recontextualized it, got rid of the notion of absolute time, absolute space. They became entangled. Time and space are now entangled. And there's no such thing as absolute velocity, no such thing as absolute position. And many such other quandaries, which are very paradoxical and tricky. And that completely changed how you view reality. Although, of course, the problem is that people don't go around thinking of reality on terms of Einstein's general relativity. They still have a very naive view of reality. They have the Newtonian view of reality. So really, most people, even the most scientific people in practice, their view of reality is about 400 years out of date. If you want to be true to science. And then, of course, after that came quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics further complicated things and really broke our conventional notions of a physical three-dimensional reality. This sort of just completely flew out the window. But of course, most people don't think of the world in a quantum mechanical way. And that's right, and quantum mechanics itself is a conceptual scheme. You have to understand. And there's a lot of shenanigans that go on within how science misunderstands quantum mechanics. So it's all tricky stuff. Darwinian evolution is another one of these examples. Today, because spiral dynamic stage orange is on the rise, materialism is on the rise, atheism is on the rise, all these are popular, science is popular, religion is kind of becoming an old, ancient, archaic dinosaur that's dying out, at least fundamentalist religion. So with that, people now view the whole world as a sort of Darwinian evolution playground, where it's like, oh, creatures are evolving, and it's all Darwinian, it's survival of the fittest. But you don't actually see evolution in progress, if you're honest about it. It's a contextual scheme that you bring to some situation. And then that colors how you view your relationships, how you view sports, how you view business and competition and governments and societies and economics. Like, all this is colored by these conceptual schemes that you have. And yet most people just accept it as fact. Now, I'm not denying here, per se, that Darwinian evolution is false. I'm not denying general relativity. I'm not denying that the Earth is orbiting around the sun. I'm not denying any of these things. I'm just pointing out what these things actually are. They are conceptual schemes and they are context. And if they are context, that means they can be recontextualized. And that's the key. That's why this is so important. Of course, you can really start to appreciate the importance of context with the example of The Matrix. That's why that movie was so such a big cultural phenomenon, because it really got you to buy into the significance of what recontextualization is. Neo discovers that he's inside the Matrix. That completely changes what he thinks reality is for him. And that opens up the possibility of escaping the old context into some radically new context, or in his case, actually escaping the Matrix entirely. And of course, that's ultimately why we're talking about context, is because what you can discover is you can discover how to escape this entire conceptual, contextual game. But there's more to it than just that. So there's really two kinds of recontextualization. What I call ordinary and radical. The ordinary kind is like my cupcake story. It's a surprising twist or a shock, but it's not reality shattering. When I discovered that this cupcake fell on the floor and that actually my friend didn't steal it, or my school buddy didn't steal it, that that didn't shake my reality. That wasn't really a metaphysical discovery. The physics of reality didn't change, but it was still psychologically significant to me. It affected my mood. It affected my emotions. It affected my attitude. And so you will find in your own life probably examples like my cupcake story, where stuff was recontextualized for you. This is sort of like on the level of psychology or in the social domain. And that was very significant. For example, if you're depressed, some recontextualization in the psychological or social domain could lift that depression. Or maybe you're depressed because you're putting certain situations or facts in your life into improper context. So that's what therapy is often about, is about changing the context, the psychological context. But this is still ordinary recontextualization. So examples of this would be plot twists in movies like Star Wars, Fight Club, Unusual Suspects, like the Luke, I Am Your Father recontextualization. See, that was very significant because that completely changed how you viewed Luke and Darth Vader and their relationship after you discovered that Darth Vader is Luke's father. Or in Fight Club, the twist at the end when you discover, by the way, spoiler alert, when you discover that the two main characters are actually identical, they're one and the same character, that recontextualizes in an instant everything that was going on previously in the movie. And that's very significant. And notice what your mind does in that situation. When you have that aha moment, that epiphany, that recontextualization, your mind then has to backtrack, go back into the past, go through all the scenes in the movie, think through them again, but now refactor them or recontextualize them to put them in the proper context, because it realizes, oh shit, 90% of the whole movie was in the wrong context. And that's what's so enjoyable and amazing about that movie, if people like that movie. I'm actually not a big fan of that movie, but that's for another day. Same thing with Usual Suspects. When you discover at the very, very end that Kevin Spacey's character, who was playing stupid the entire time, was actually the evil villain Kaiser Soze. When you discover that, and it's like the very end of the movie, and he's able to escape, and then you have to go back and you have to refactor all the scenes and think about them. He planned that. Oh, he did. Oh, look how evil he was. Da da da. So everything changes. How about if you discovered that the person who bullied you in school did so because his mother died from cancer? That would be pretty significant, wouldn't it? Again, that's not a metaphysical recontextualization. That doesn't change your understanding of physical reality. But psychologically, that could be very significant. Like, you could have harbored some animosity towards that bully for 10, 20 years of your life. But then maybe you meet him at a class reunion and you discover that actually, oh, what happened back then is that his mother died from cancer. And that's why he was such an asshole to you. It's like, oh, dude, I understand. Okay, I understand. And then you can let go of that. See? How about if you discover that you were adopted? That would be a pretty significant, but still ordinary, what I call the ordinary type of recontextualization. It would be very significant to you psychologically, but it wouldn't change your understanding of reality. And then, of course, there's the second type, which is the really interesting type, which is what I call radical recontextualization. This is one where actually it affects physical reality. It flips some aspect of physical reality inside out. Radical recontextualization of this kind can come from psychedelics, yoga, meditation, self-inquiry, contemplation, really any kind of contemplative or mystical practices. And in fact, that's the whole point of doing those practices, is to recontextualize this very present moment that you're having right now. So the reason I'm talking about this is because there is something hidden in plain sight right now, within this very experience that you're having right now, such that if we recontextualize this very present experience, you will realize that what this present experience is and has always been your entire life has not been life. This isn't life that's happening right here. This is not a physical universe. You're not inside some sort of Big Bang right now. You're not really a human being. You're not even having this experience right now, even though you think you are. You think you're having an experience right now because of the context in which you're framing it. That's a conceptual context. When you remove that context, this very present experience, it won't physically change per se. I'm not saying that some magical unicorn will fly in here and angels will come down from the clouds and God in his bearded form will appear to you sitting on a throne glowing with light. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that this very boring, mundane experience you're having right now will be recontextualized such that you will awaken to the fact that this right here is God. This, it's been God the whole time. That's a radical recontextualization. When you discover that this is God, you also discover that you were never here. This was never your life. There isn't just one such radical recontextualization. There are many, which is why there are many facets to awakening, which is why awakening is a complicated topic. And it's not as simple-minded as just, hey, I'm awake and that's it and it's done. No, there's many facets. Other examples of radical recontextualization include, for example, realizing that perception is actually being. That's one facet. That's basically what I just described to you. Another one is discovering that actually you are God. Another one is realizing that reality, everything you see here, is a dream or a hallucination. That's another facet. All of these facets are, in a sense, related, but also distinct from each other. You can realize that everything here is made of consciousness. You can discover that every material object is consciousness. I've talked about that in the past in my What is Consciousness episode. You can realize that there is no such thing as past and future, that past and future are just concepts, and that there is only eternity. So this moment that's happening right now, It's not a instant in a long timeline. This moment that's happening right now, this very word that I'm saying now and now and now and now, each one of these words has existed for eternity. Even though it's seeming like right now time is flowing and I'm saying different words, and it's seeming like the words I said just a second ago are now gone, that's how it seems, but each one of those exists in eternity. And this very moment right now is eternity. But for you to be conscious of that, you need a radical recontextualization to happen. And notice that a radical recontextualization is not a belief. It's not something you believe. It doesn't help that you believe it. It doesn't help that you believe in God. It doesn't help that you believe me. All the stuff that I'm saying, that doesn't help you at all. That doesn't change the context unless it actually does. If it does, then some radical shit will happen to you and then it'll be way beyond belief for you. But the point is to actually have the recontextualization happen. Not to talk about it, not to think about it, not to believe it, but to have it happen. That's a crucial distinction. You can also have a radical recontextualization where you realize that non-existence is a concept and that actually there's no such thing as non-existence. Everything exists. That's pretty radical to realize that. You can also have another radical recontextualization where you realize that everything that you see around you right now and all of reality is actually nothing and that it never actually happened. So what I'm talking about right now and everything that I've been saying, it might seem like this stuff is actually happening in real life, but actually, if you properly recontextualize what this is that's happening here, you will realize that actually it's nothing and that nothing has ever happened. That's a pretty deep one. You're not likely to get that one very easily. You can also recontextualize every physical object such that if you take a physical object, like let's say you take a pencil, you can look at that pencil and you can look at it for so long that, and you remove all the metaphysical baggage that you have that you're projecting onto it, that you're using to interpret it, such that the finiteness of the pencil will disappear and you will become conscious that this pencil is actually infinite. That's a pretty radical one too. You can also recontextualize all of reality such that you discover that you actually created the universe. You created it. That's a pretty radical one too. Of course, you can recontextualize to discover that actually you never existed, you were never born, and you will never die, and that what you are is you're a concept. You are a concept. You were born as a concept, and you will die as a concept. But this experience that's happening right now, this is not a concept. The experience is not a concept. But you, what you think you are, that human being, that's a concept. The body's not a concept. But you inside the body, that's a concept. That's a pretty deep one too. Other examples. Imagine if you discovered that what life is really isn't you being a human being who's just kind of like living to survive according to Darwinian evolution, but actually you are something that an alien species is simulating in their computers in order to harvest your experiences, to learn from your experiences in life, such that when you're going through all the shit you're going through in life, like when you're, you stub your toe in the morning and it hurts, aliens are collecting that information or just like storing it in their databases. Or like when you're sitting there eating an apple, they're collecting that information of like what apples taste like and they're kind of storing it in their databases. And when you fall in love, they're collecting that. And when you're having sex, they're collecting that. And when you get cancer and you're dying, they'll collect that experience as well. So they're collecting all these experiences. So imagine if you discovered one day, I'm not saying this is actually possible. I'm saying imagine if you could discover something like that, how radically that would recontextualize your very experience of life. Notice that every single moment from that point on would be completely different for you, even though nothing would really change about your life. Your life would still go on. You'd still have to get up in the morning and you'd still stub your toe and you'd still eat apples and you'd still have sex and you'd still maybe get a disease at some point and die. All that would still happen, but how you thought of it would radically change if you knew for a fact that aliens were collecting all of your data and that what all this was just a matrix-like simulation for the pleasure and entertainment of aliens. Maybe aliens are sitting somewhere up there looking at this as like a video feed and jerking off to it. You don't know. Imagine if you discovered that. That would certainly change how you view life, wouldn't it? Probably would. So that's why it's so important, this concept. Imagine if you discovered one day that you chose your parents. You weren't just accidentally born through some physical process, but that actually, before you came into your body, into existence on this earth, that you actually selected the precise situation that you would place yourself. You selected your parents, you selected the part of the, well, first you selected the time frame, the specific era and year within human history that you would be born. So you decide, I'll be born in the 20th century or the 21st century. And then you decide, okay, I'm going to be born in some country. I'll be born in Africa, in some remote village. And you decided that for some specific reasons, because you wanted to experience what Africa was like in the 21st century. And you wanted to experience what it was like to get malaria. And you wanted to experience what it was like to live in a place where there was no stable government and where people were running around with machetes and chopping at each other and maybe trading drugs and doing this sort of stuff. Or maybe you decided, no, I want to be born in some Western European democracy in the 25th century where life is sweet and it's just this communist utopia where I can just be born and not have to work and just get supplied with schooling and education up through university, and life is easy and drugs are available for free to everybody. I can smoke pot and do this and this. Or maybe you decide, no, I want to go back into like 5th century Arabia and see what life was like then. Or maybe I want to experience what life was like as a slave in the colonial South. And you discover that, and then you incarnate and you go into that body and then you live that whole life. Now, if you actually discovered that, I'm not saying that's true, I'm saying if you discovered that, how do you think that would affect your attitude about life as you're still living inside of it? That would be pretty significant, wouldn't it? If you have a disease of some kind or some kind of physical ailment, imagine if you discovered that you created that disease for some reason. That would be pretty radical. Because right now, of course, if you have this disease, you think of yourself as a victim. It's like, oh, poor me. Why do I have this disease? Why am I so cursed? Why do other people not have this disease? What if you created that disease for some higher purpose? I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying, just consider it as a possibility. What if you discovered one day that you are the source of all the evil in the world? It's not that there are people running around, they're terrorists and Nazis and so forth, who do evil things to people for God knows what reasons, but that you actually created all of that evil yourself. I'm not necessarily saying it's true, I'm just saying imagine if you could discover that. How significantly that might recontextualize your entire life. Most people, of course, deny the possibility of radical recontextualization. They will agree with me, of course. Yeah, Leo, ordinary recontextualization is possible. I've had experiences like your cupcake story. Yeah, that stuff does happen. But now you're just getting outlandish with this stuff. You're just being fantastical. You're just coming up with stupid examples about aliens and diseases and evil and this and that and God and whatever else. You're just coming up with these silly examples. But you can't really have that happen in reality because reality is real. But of course, how do you know reality is real? That's the question. The reason that people do not want to admit of the possibility of radical recontextualization is because it undermines your sense of reality. It's very threatening. It's destabilizing. It unmoors you. Because reality for you is like an anchor. It's the thing that you can ground yourself in so that you can start to make sense of the world and live your life. Imagine what would happen if you had no anchors, if you didn't know what was real, if you woke up in the morning, you didn't even know if this stuff was real. How would you live? What would you do? How would you know what's right and what's wrong? All of those would be very important questions and you would be confused about it. And you wouldn't know who to turn to because you might go to some professor and ask him, but how can you trust the professor? How do you know that what he tells you is actually right? You see, by asking a professor, you're grounding yourself in the professor's authority. By asking the Quran, you're grounding yourself in the Quran's authority. By coming up with your own theories, you're now grounding yourself in the authority of your own theories or logic or whatever. So what every human being fundamentally is doing is they are somehow finding a way to anchor themselves. Otherwise, they have an existential crisis. They don't know what to do or what they're doing here. You don't even know if you were born, if you really are honest. Because to know that you were born, you have to anchor yourself in your memories. Your memories, you have to believe that they're reliable. How do you know that? Well, Leo, my memory usually is reliable. But how do you know that? How do you know some fake memories weren't implanted into your mind when you were created? Maybe you were genetically engineered in some test tube, and then we implanted your mind with some memories that you were born in such and such a place, with such and such parents, and under such and such conditions. How do you know? You see, but this fucks with your reality too much. People usually don't like having their reality fucked with, which I find actually really odd because I love getting my reality fucked with. To me, this is the best stuff ever. Like, the more my reality can get fucked, the better. I love it. I love it. It's almost like sex, you know, like a really feminine woman will love to get her brains fucked out. And you got to approach reality in the same way, even if you're a man. You gotta like kind of want the magnificence of reality to fuck your brains out, to mind fuck, like literally mind fuck you until your sense of self is destroyed. And that's what enlightenment is. It's the most beautiful thing. It's the most amazing thing, but it does require surrender. It does require humility. It requires a sort of acquired taste for getting mind fucked. And some people, they don't like that because they're too busy protecting, defending, clinging to stuff. You know, every ego is clinging to stuff. Why do you think it's clinging to stuff? Fundamentally, you're clinging to stuff because that's how you ground. You got to ground yourself in something, and whatever you ground yourself in is going to be a thing. Even an idea is a thing. A Bible, a professor, your university diploma, what your parents told you, what Muhammad told you, you know, whatever. You're trying to ground yourself. Even some past mystical experience you've had. If you've had an enlightenment experience in the past, maybe you just had a glimpse, a little awakening, then it went away after a few days. Okay. But now, see, you're trying to ground yourself in that. But the point is that reality is fundamentally groundless. And that's what nobody wants to admit. Imagine, just imagine, if one day in the future, mankind discovered a truth about reality that was so radical that it undermined the foundations of all of modern mathematics. Just invalidated the entire field of mathematics. Is that possible? Is such a thing possible? If you ask most scientists, rationalists, atheists, materialists, and ordinary people, they will say no. And what I just want you to consider is that maybe it's possible. Now, the mistake here would be to say, Leo, but how is it possible? Because you see, as soon as you ask the question, how is it possible, that now opens us up to the next problem, which is a failure of imagination. Don't confuse a failure of imagination on your part with impossibility or possibility on the part of the universe. The universe could have a lot of tricks up its sleeve. You got to stay humble and not think that just because I can't imagine it, it can't happen. That is the source of much epistemic wrong thinking and delusion. So the moral of the story with all this recontextualization business is that I just want you to start to take radical recontextualization seriously as a possibility. That will really open up your mind and open you up to the highest levels of development, stage turquoise. I want you to take seriously the idea that actually facts in and of themselves are rather meaningless. And what's far more important is the context in which the facts are placed. Really deeply understand that you can have all the right facts, but still deeply misunderstand reality. Which is the whole problem with modern science. It gets the facts right, but it gets the understanding wrong. Wrong context is the perfect self-deception mechanism. So add this one to that list of self-deception mechanisms I gave you in my self-deception three-part series. Scientists and rationalists underestimate the degree to which 180-degree reversals of factual situations are possible through changes of context. Science is really good at context, but terrible, really good at content, but terrible at context. Academics are needed to get the content right, and mystics and sages are needed to get the context right. So you see, we do need both. I'm not saying academics are completely useless and that we should burn them all at the stake, as much as maybe I would enjoy that. No, academics, they serve a valid function. Lab technicians, they serve a valid function. We need technical scientists to go out there and do the measurements, but don't count on them to get the big picture right. For that, you need sages and mystics. So it's really by combining the two together that you get the best understanding of reality possible. You get the context right, and then you also get the content right. And don't make the mistake of thinking just because you got the context right, that then you will automatically understand all the content. No. For example, the Buddha got the context right, but the Buddha didn't know anything about nuclear physics or about evolution or about biology or about cells or about astronomy or about cosmology, right? He didn't know about these things because those things are content. So when you get enlightened, that's about getting the context right. You become aware and awake to the context. And by the way, the context for everything is the universal self, I. I is the context of everything. But then the content, part of your awakening is that you realize that the content is infinite. So this is why science will never end. It will keep going on and on and on forever. Which is actually really interesting because, if the content is actually infinite, like I'm saying, that means that all the science that mankind has done for the last 2,000 years, let's say, it is infinitely far away from understanding all of the content of reality, because the content of reality is infinite, and the science that man has done is only 2,000 years. That means that if science keeps working for another trillion years, it will be as far away from understanding reality as it is today, as it was 2,000 years ago. You see, that's the problem with science, is that you think that you're actually getting deeper and deeper understanding of reality. But that's only because you assume reality is finite, so you're assuming that at some point you're going to get to the bottom of things. But if reality turns out to be infinite, then that assumption doesn't hold, and therefore you will be chasing your tail to infinity forever for a trillion years. See? So wouldn't it be nice to realize this stuff now rather than waiting a trillion years to discover it? And lastly, I just want you to become much more highly context sensitive. Not just to metaphysical context, which of course is very important, but also, for example, historical context. I see a lot of people being ahistorical, because to have proper historical context means you got to do a lot of reading, a lot of study. Of course, people are lazy and they're ignorant, so they don't do a lot of reading and studying of history. They don't bother to learn the details. And so they don't have proper context for things. Like someone might read a story about the Buddha and say, oh, the Buddha was sexist because the Buddha didn't want to allow for female monks and nuns. But you have to understand the context. What was the context of ancient India 2,500 years ago? Very different from today. You can't take today's equal rights context and apply it to the Buddha 2,500 years ago. Likewise, people criticize Muhammad for being a warlord. Yeah. Today, of course, if someone was a warlord in modern urban United States, stage green, spiral dynamics, was a warlord, yeah, that would be a big problem. But back in ancient Arabia, 1,500 years ago, where the predominant stage was purple and red, being a warlord was actually a relatively advanced step in evolution, because warlords are actually above purple tribes. See? Context, important. How about Marcus Aurelius? Marcus Aurelius slaughtered Christians. Some people hold that against him. Well, you got to understand the context. Slaughtering Christians back then was supposed to be correct because they were a sect that was corrupting the society back then. They weren't like Christians today. How about Thomas Jefferson owning slaves? Seems horrible from 21st century stage green, but I'm sure he was much more advanced than most people in the world 200 years ago or so, even though he owned slaves, right? So you gotta put this stuff into context. Stage orange, which is where Thomas Jefferson was at 200 years ago, that was innovative, just like that was the cutting edge back then. The U.S. Constitution, stage orange document, was a very innovative document for that time. Today, it's getting a little out of date. We need a more green constitution. But that's another topic. Also, be highly context sensitive with psychological context, social context, and of course, the context of all teachings. You have to understand that when a teaching comes at you, whether it's through a video, through a book, through a live seminar, whatever you're doing, any kind of teaching, whether it's a business teaching, actualize.org teaching, some non-dual teaching, some relationship advice, pickup teaching, whatever, you have to put it into context, especially with mystical teachings, especially with the stuff that I talk about. A lot of times you see gurus giving contradictory advice to different people with similar issues. Like there might be a guru and two students come to him, student A and student B. Both of them have a similar problem. And so student A asks the guru, what should I do? And the guru tells him to do one thing. Then the next day, student B asks the guru, what should I do about my problem? It's similar. And the guy will tell him to do the opposite thing. And then those two people will get together the next day and they will say, hey, what did he tell you? And what did he tell you? And it's like, oh, he told me to do this. And no, he told me to do the opposite of that. Why is that? Is he lying to me? Is he trying to trick us? Is he playing games? No, it's because the guru is very context sensitive. So the guru is giving you the teaching to person A that person needs for his specific situation. The guru is sensitive to that person's energy pattern. The guru is sensitive to that person's framing of their question. Why are they asking the question? What is their level of development? Are they ready for some advanced teaching, or do they need an intermediary teaching or a newbie teaching? You see, what can they handle? The guru has to evaluate all these things. The guru does this in an instant and pops out an answer. But then the other person who has the same problem but can't handle the advanced answer or can't understand what the guru is going to tell this guy has to give him a different answer. Context sensitivity. And so when you're reading some mystical literature, you have to be very careful about interpreting these teachings and putting them into the proper context. Make sure that they actually fit with your situation, with someone at your level. Just because Eckhart Tolle says something doesn't mean that it's going to work for you at your level, at this time, at this stage of development, in this part of the country or this part of the world that you're in. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. That takes some discernment on your part to figure that out. All right, that's it. I'm done here. Please remember to click that like button for me and come check out actualize.org. That's my website. Check out the blog. I'm posting new stuff there all the time, some profound insights. check out the forum. The forum is doing great. We're having more and more interesting and deeper discussions about spiral dynamics, other kinds of cool topics on the forum. So come check it out. I think you can potentially find some interesting resources there that will deepen this journey for you. Come check out the book list. Lots of books for you to read that will recontextualize stuff for you. Come check out the Life Purpose course. And lastly, what I want to say is that I want you to understand the significance of what we're doing with this work. We are trying to develop an understanding that is deeper than the understanding that the best academics have. I'm talking about people in Harvard and Princeton and Stanford and Yale and all these prestigious places. And some of these academics, they do great work. So, you know, I can't criticize them. But just understand that almost none of them really understand what reality is about or how to actually live life. Their understanding is very narrow, very technical, very little picture. They're not connecting all the dots. They're not at stage turquoise. They're not going to the ultimate depths of human understanding that are possible. And you might wonder, Leo, but how can that be? I mean, these people get paid lots of money and they get grants and they get PhDs and Nobel Prizes and they write books and they give big speaking tours and they're famous and they're these big celebrities and everybody knows these physicists and these social scientists and psychologists and all this. How could they not know? It makes no sense. How is it possible that just some guy on YouTube could know more than these people? And I'm not trying to be arrogant. I'm not trying to say that I know more than these people. Again, it's very context sensitive. In certain places, I know more. In certain places, I know a lot less. It all depends on what we're talking about. Different domains. My focus and your focus is the big picture. And what you got to understand is that someone who is not focused on the big picture will never understand the big picture. It's very easy to get sucked into academia and to spend 20 years getting immersed into academic culture and to academic bureaucracy and just kind of go through that. And then you become this bureaucratic little picture academic. And even though you can publish great books, you can even win Nobel Prizes, you are never going to get the big picture with that approach. And it's just that simple. That's the explanation for why they're not doing it. They're not doing it because they're not after it. And they're not after it because they are not open-minded enough. They don't think it's actually possible or that it's important. Or because it directly contradicts their work methodologies, their paradigms, and their institutional norms. You see, there's a lot of academic and cultural norms in universities, which when you're in them for a long time and you grow up in them, which means that you go to school and you go to undergrad school, then grad school and all this, by the time you're done with all that, you are so thoroughly indoctrinated that you are a fish in water. You don't know that you've been indoctrinated. You don't think of those things that you are taught as indoctrination. You think of them as reality. And then by that point, you're just so locked in and so bought into the paradigm. You've sunk so much money and time into it. You're hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, student debt, and all this sort of stuff that you got just to get your PhD. And now you got to publish papers, and there's all these responsibilities on you. You got to teach, you got to do research, you got to get grant money, you got to fulfill on your promises to keep your grant money. That it just becomes this cycle, right? It just becomes this mindless cycle, and there's no real deep understanding. Not to mention which, universities these days are really getting corrupted by the capitalist system and by businesses and by corporations, such that if you're trying to pursue some line of research which is not directly tied with business interests, it's not something you can patent, it's not something you can sell and make a huge lot of money on and go IPO. And of course, the deepest mystical truths are completely free and they're democratic, so you can't monopolize them, you can't patent them. And they've all been discovered thousands of years ago, so you're not discovering anything new. So you can't really publish any groundbreaking research on this stuff. So of course, for academics in that system, it's not viable. They can't survive in that system. they'll go hungry. You know, so they got to play the survival game. And the survival game has nothing to do with understanding and with truth. And in fact, it's mostly the opposite of that. If you're playing the survival game, we can almost guarantee that you will never come to the deepest understanding of what reality is. So stick around with actualize.org. And my commitment to you is to try to deliver content which is not technical, but which is big picture. And all the stuff, as you watch it, it'll all come together for you. You will have this very big picture synthesis, and you will have an understanding. You'll be shocked at how much you understand, and you'll be amazed at just how ignorant otherwise intelligent and scientific people are compared to you, even though all you've done is basically just watch some YouTube videos.